My guest on Fresh Air is cellist Lynn Harrell. He was raised in Dallas and grew up in a home where music was the first language. His father was Metropolitan Opera baritone Mac Harrell. His mother, Marjorie Fulton, was a violinist. Harrell made his orchestral debut while in his mid-teens and was appointed principal cellist for the Cleveland Orchestra under the baton of George Zell at age 21. He's still the youngest principal in the history of that orchestra. In 1970, Harrell left the Cleveland Orchestra to begin a solo career. Since then, he's appeared with almost every major orchestra in the world, maintaining a touring schedule that takes him to approximately 115 halls a year. His work with performers like the pianist Murray Pariah and Emmanuel Ax seems to bring out Harrell's genial and hearty approach to playing and has earned him the acclaim of his peers. In 1975, Harrell and Pariah were co-recipients of the first Avery Fisher Prize, awarded on the basis of balloting of fellow musicians. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Before we actually talk, I'd like to show off some of your playing. What I want to do is play the opening of the Shostakovich Cello Concerto No. 1, Opus 107. We're going to hear Bernard Haitink conducting the Concertgebouw Orchestra. And this is the opening of the first movement. My guest, Lynn Harrell, the cello soloist on that recording of the Shostakovich Cello Concerto No. 1, Opus 107, with Bernard Haitink conducting the Concertgebouw Orchestra. Is that as exhilarating to play as it is to listen to?
Oh, indeed it is. I think this kind of cold, clammy excitement and quivering intensity is the main thing that I'm feeling when I start to play that. It's almost impossible to control the explosive quality of the rhythm and the vitality required enough to actually keep it in wraps enough for it to be a public performance. I find this piece so granite and focused and powerful that it's dwarfing to come in contact with it. And at the beginning of the music sounds perhaps a little bit gay, a little bit just bouncy, but those sudden crescendos, the timpani claps, the the offbeat da-da-da-da-da-da-da just slowly scratches at you until it's just at the breaking point. It's very exciting.
Are you thinking technique, or are you just thinking what you're feeling when you're playing that?
I'm thinking technique occasionally when it gets very difficult, but mostly I'm just reacting to the emotional picture of the music.
You are, I think, one of the few soloists who actually started with an orchestral career. You started your career with the Cleveland Orchestra. Did you want to eventually become a soloist?
I think so, when I was very young. But I recognized that before my generation, it was often the case that a cello soloist, not so violin or piano, of course, that they became solo cellists after being in orchestra. It's a kind of part of their training to be part of an ensemble, because the cello is sometimes the leading soprano voice of the piece that you're playing, but sometimes it's just the bass line, the foundation, or even an inner voice. So you have to know more than, I think, a violinist or a pianist, that you're just one you're just one spoke in the wheel at times.
You have to be pretty self-effacing.
Yes.
How did you like that?
It fit with my character fine. Now, I think perhaps studying an instrument changes the character, because you have to study a musical instrument very seriously into your puberty years, even before. So the music that you play, the sound of the instrument, the size, the qualities of it, what it feels like physically to play, I think has an effect on the personality development of the person who spends all those hours alone in the practice room with the highly emotional world of making music and feeling emotional about it themselves. Something's bound to happen.
Do you think cello affected your personality?
Absolutely.
How so?
I think the cello is an instrument, as I say, that has to adjust and be part of the group more than some of the other instruments. And I'm very much more easygoing character in certain respects. Other times, I feel I want to be the leader. I want to be the soloist and the dominating factor within an ensemble. But I have a lot of flexibility in that, just because I think of the cello.
Did you choose to start your career in an orchestra so that you'd learn ensemble playing better? You'd learn to be part of a larger group?
Yes. My teacher at that time, Leonard Rose, a great American cellist, played in years in orchestra, and he thought it was a wonderful musical training. Also, I had recently been orphaned, and I needed to have some financial security. And it was just came along at the right time in my musical development as well.
Your father died, I believe, when you were 16, and your mother died in an auto accident 3 years after that. Was the orchestra like a surrogate family for you?
Oh, yes, yes. I was so much younger than my other colleagues in the orchestra. And in a way, I was very lonely, because I couldn't really relate to them one-on-one, because they were all as old as my parents. And their children were too young for me. And the schedule of the orchestra was very demanding. So although there was a university in Cleveland, I didn't really have time to get involved with people my own age at the time. So it was a difficult time, but one that I wouldn't trade at all, because that's the foundation of my musical and intellectual beginning.
You left the Cleveland Orchestra, I believe, shortly after George Zell passed away. Was that why you left the orchestra?
Yes, I wanted to do more solo playing. And I felt I had accomplished becoming a good principal player of an orchestra. And I just knew that it was impossible to coordinate two schedules, one of traveling around and playing as a soloist, and one as being the responsible leader of a section of a great symphony orchestra. So it was one or the other. I thought at that time that maybe I'd go back into orchestra. But then when I started playing the solo repertoire, which I hadn't played for a good 10 years, I realized that there's where my heart lay. And I loved playing that solo music. And I loved being out there on front of the stage and being a soloist.
Your parents were both musicians. And as you had mentioned, they both died when you were a teenager. Most musicians, especially when they're young, I think, really immerse themselves so totally in music and shut out a lot of other parts of of life. And I was wondering if you went through that even more so because of the tragedies in your own family, because you were probably forced to be more of a loner than you might have even chosen to be.
Yes, that's definitely true. I did do that, and it sometimes causes problems of adjustment for me today, because that world of myself, the hotel room, the cello, and maybe room service, can be a very complete one when I'm on tour and away from my family and away from my friends. And it's only over a protracted long period of time do I realize that that I'm not really happy living that way anymore. But certainly for a number of years, it was a kind of cocoon that was a protection against the harshness of the outside world. And in that way, music was like a savior to me. It really was a balm on hurt minds.
Your father was a Metropolitan Opera baritone. Your mother was a violinist. When you decided to start playing music, was there pressure on you to be great and to really shine?
No, there wasn't. In fact, my parents were so afraid that they would innuendo that kind of pressure that they didn't take any kind of active interest or concern with my music at all. And in school orchestras and music organizations, they'd always say, well, of course, Lin has the great advantage of his parents. But I didn't have one musical discussion with either one of them. Never went to my father's or mother's concerts. It was as though the only thing that did rub off was that music as a way of life, as a just a normal thing to do, was part of my family upbringing. Putting on a tie, practicing your instrument, warming up, putting a full dress on or a dress, and going out on stage and performing in front of people was the way people lived, as far as I was concerned. And it was very dramatic when I went to Florida on a vacation and I saw Chris Everett practicing tennis with her father. And I realized that her upbringing in tennis was the same sort of thing that I had in music. Just a way of life, not just something you choose as a profession.
Because your father recorded, you've been able to go back and hear him sing as a mature adult. You've been able to use your developed ears now to listen to him. Does he sound different than you remember him sounding when you were young?
No, not at all. It's overpowering to me emotionally, particularly when I am using a recording of my father's as a demonstration of something in a master class in my teaching. It's all I can do to control not just breaking up and weeping out of my misery of missing him and his art. On the other hand, I realize now more because I am a father, that he wasn't such a good daddy in certain respects. So it sort of balances out. It's very interesting.
Well, in that respect, you're probably trying to make up for that or use that as a guide for what you should or shouldn't be doing as a father, because now you're the father musician. You have twins, I think.
Yes, they're 6 years old, and they've started studying an instrument, piano and violin. And I want them to be open to the beauty and the extraordinary world that music brings. And all music, I think, brings something new to the human experience. But not so that they feel pressured that they're going to have to succeed on a certain high professional level. That would be unfortunate to have them under that kind of pressure. Some children like that kind of pressure, adjust to it, and are fine, but I don't want to take the chance.
You once said in an interview that you were kind of sorry in a way that your mother had to sacrifice her career to have children. And now that you're a parent, I wonder if you still feel that way.
No, I don't. Obviously, it was an ambivalence in her. I remember it being an ambivalence because she wanted to have more of a solo activity and wanted to do more playing. And she was hampered and had to look after my brother and sister and myself. But that was what she chose. It, of course, was a completely different time. The women's movement wasn't even a glint in the eye. So it was there's a difference. Different generation, but I think she could have enjoyed her life more if she had the sense that she could, like contemporary women do now, have people look after the children while she did more of the professional thing that she wanted to do.
My guest is cellist Lynn Harrell, and we'll be back after this. This is Fresh Air. I want to play an excerpt of your recent recording of the Bach cello suites, and I'm wondering if learning to play this is a rite of passage for cellists.
Oh, I think one would have to say so. In Casals, the great old Spanish master who died just in the mid-70s, he really was the Paganini of the cello. He was the first one in the turn of the 19th century to start to play the instrument so much better. He sort of discovered the cello suites as something more than just technical practices. And they are profound pieces of music. They aren't the St. Matthew Passion. They're not as good, I don't think, even as the Brandenburg Concerti. But they're astounding still. When you're working with a genius like Bach, or, a Michelangelo etching, it's pretty astounding. It's not the Sistine Chapel, okay, but it's quite amazing. So that's what these suites are like. For the cellist, it is a real passage to go through, to develop one's style, and to come up face-to-face with such masterpieces. And they require so much, technically, musically, aesthetically, and in every way, that it's a marvelous challenge.
Let's give a listen to your performance of the Gigue from Bach's Cello Suite No. 1 in G major. My guest, Lynn Harrell, performing the Gigue from Bach's Cello Suite No. 1 in G major. I really have to say, it's a beautiful performance, and I think of the cello as having just a very emotionally direct sound, maybe more so than most instruments, and I don't know if that sounds silly or not.
No, it's perceptive of you, I think, because the cello is the only string instrument that plays really in the speaking and vocal singing registers of all four voices. Bass, baritone, mezzo-soprano, and soprano. Even the highest notes of the coloratura we can play on the cello. We often are required to by the great romantic composers. But so there's that immediacy out of identification to being human that it has, that some of the other instruments, the clarinet doesn't vibrate. The natural human voice does, sometimes quivers if it's very emotionally distraught. The oboe has a reed, and you can hear that it plays with vocal characteristics, but that it's a little bit arbitrary. I hate to say that about that instrument that I love so much. Piano, of course, is slightly a percussive instrument. When I start talking about all these other instruments, it sounds like I don't think any of them are any good. I love them all.
Obviously, but you really love cello.
I really love the cello for those direct qualities of communication that you mentioned.
Do you think the fact that your father was a singer attracted you to an instrument that has such a vocal range to it?
I think so, in a very profound way, because I don't really remember him singing in my conscious mind. But I think just the directness of the communication of the human voice is the first thing we use. It's the first thing we cry out when we're born. It's the thing we use. So the cello is, in its nature, is very, very akin to that. And the music has been written for it, the best music, takes that in consideration.
Do you have to be cautious in a way to not exploit the emotional quality of the instrument, to not be too schmaltzy? Because there is, I think, that possibility with an instrument that is so emotionally charged.
Oh, yes. You have to do that very carefully in classic and Baroque music, where part of the eloquence of the communication is the fact that everything is prim and proper and the white wig is all in place, but the tears might be overflowing from the eyelids, but the fact that they can't rip the shirt open and scream and stab oneself, undress, or do any of those late romantic idealized activities, the fact that things are more in check is very much adds to the eloquence, I think.
What do you feel physically when you play? Does your body vibrate along with the cello?
A little bit, yes, particularly the lower notes. I hold the top of the instrument against my neck as a sort of a contact point, balanced with with the other edge of the other side of the cello, with holding it with the knees. So a lot of the vibrations of the instrument flow into my neck and spine and chest, and particularly when you're playing very forcefully the lower tones of the instrument, your vision sometimes is slightly blurred because you're quivering right along with the vibrations of the instrument. This, of course, has a very strange effect on the development of character.
That's what you were talking about earlier. Now I understand.
Yes, right.
I know a lot of musicians have this ideal sound in their head that they're always striving for, and they always feel they never reach except for on that rare occasion. Do you have such an ideal in your head? And if you do, do you think you could describe it?
Well, it would be embarrassing if I said no. Yes, I think I do. But that sound is not just the cello sound. It's the nature of the cello sonority, the instrument that I've chosen, but with all the breadth and depth and meaningfulness of the very greatest orators or singers. If you listen to John Gielgud or Ralph Richardson, you just have an idea that certain words can just be so pregnant with meaning. And with an instrument that has four strings and you rub it with some horse hair with some rosin on it, it's just so diluted. So that's basically what I have in my head, and that's why it feels like it's always totally inadequate when it comes out.
What do you do when you're not getting the sound you want? Every, I think, instrument has its own set of neuroses associated with it. What do you do when you feel like, this isn't working, I have to make a change?
Yes. Yes, I recently got a Stradivari, one of the very great instruments of all time, made in 1673. And there are now times when I think, this instrument's terrible, because I've gotten used to it and I've gotten closer to wanting to make it sound a certain way. Fidget, fuss. It's all in the mind, and I try to sometimes recognize that. I remember recording and saying to the recording producer, let's listen to this tape a little bit longer because I've just started to practice something in this part of the session and I want to see what it sounds like. And I listened, and here I was playing one passage over and over again. And each time, as far as I could hear from the microphones and from the tape, was perfect. And yet I was struggling back and forth over and over again, sort of aggravatingly knocking my head against the wall. Why? Where was I? It's very symbiotic, kind of weird relationship that goes on there.
I was reading a piece about you written by your wife, who's a journalist named Linda Blandford, and she was saying that you live in constant fear of getting a cold because you don't like to have a cold when you're performing. But on the other hand, you're really careless about your hands and that you change flat tires and do hammering around the house, and it drives her crazy.
Yes.
So you don't worry about your hands?
No. No, the moment I start really trying to be concerned about my hands or that part of my body that I'm just going to need to play, something goes wrong. You know, it's so like if you take borrow a friend's Rolls Royce, you suddenly are so terribly nervous driving on the street, you're much more likely to have an accident.
One other thing, there's a small group of really brilliant cellists performing now. You are among them. And I wonder if you see yourselves as friends or competitors. You're sometimes recording the same parts of the repertoire. The repertoire isn't that vast. So is there this competitive edge to your relationship?
I think so. I think that's just in the nature of it. We probably think that each of us is better than the other. But on the other hand, we recognize that we're just different. And it's wonderful that in music, in art, you can't say that Rembrandt was a greater painter than Vermeer or Goya. They're just different. Velasquez, they're just different. And we try to remember that. But it's sometimes difficult. It's sometimes easy to just think that so-and-so is a wonderful cellist, but I can do this that he can't do. Not to really be truthful with oneself that artist is able to do some things that I'm not able to do. And those truths are sometimes difficult to live up to and to recognize and to try to do something about them. That slight competitiveness is a very healthy one, I think. It's caused cello playing in the last generation to advance an incredible amount. In relation to the violin as a solo instrument, the cello has had only since, let's say, 1950, the most outstanding technical accomplished virtuosos on the instrument, while the violin has had them since the late 19th century. So that's because we've all heard each other on record and broadcasts and whatnot, and we said, oh my gosh, that's pretty good. I better go back and practice. It's healthy.
Lynn Harrell, I love your playing, and I thank you very much for being with us today.
A great delight. Thank you.
My guest has been Lynn Harrell, one of today's leading cellists. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.